Hi, this is Bill Lindeke for the Streets.mn podcast, conversations about transportation, public space, and urban design in the Twin Cities. The podcast this week is a conversation with Kenny Blumenfeld, who is a writer, storm chaser, and climate scientist who teaches meteorology and geography at the University of Minnesota and at Metro State University. For years, Kenny has written monthly weather reports that offer details of weather events while explaining the complex meteorological forces that create them. He's also working on a documentary about winter focused on Minnesota's changing climate. Kenny and I sat down last week at Senior Wong's in downtown St. Paul to talk about how Minnesota's climate affects our cities, the great weather disasters of Minnesota history, the heat island effect, and why Minnesotans seem so hell-bent on finding ways to stay inside all year long. I think you'll enjoy the conversation. I'm here with Kenny Blumenfeld, who is a fellow geographer and a PhD in geography. You got yours a few years ago, Kenny. I remember it when you did that. And you're kind of an expert in meteorology and weather in general. How would you describe yourself?
Oh, that's a good question. I guess I would say, yeah, I'm a sort of weather enthusiast who happens to have a PhD.
Yeah.
In something that is like what a weather enthusiast would do if they took everything way too far.
Uh-huh.
Basically, it's climatology with an emphasis on urban weather hazards.
Cool. Well, I wanted to talk to you today about cities and weather and see where that takes us, that intersection. Because it's a good time of year to talk about this. I think there's, you know... Winter is coming is what people are saying a lot these days for various fantasy novel reasons. But, I mean, it's certainly true, and you feel it in the air and in people's souls and the looks in their eyes that there's something going to happen soon, and it's going to last a long time. And, you know, I had a series of questions. I saw a talk that you gave a couple months ago in downtown Minneapolis. The Love Letters to the Sky, was that what you called it?
Yes.
Yeah,
That was a lot of fun. A combination of letters that I had written to the sky and some random thoughts.
And while you were talking, it was really an excellent performance and informative situation. But I jotted down a bunch of questions about things that we could talk about cities, and maybe you would be a good brain to pick about that. Maybe we can just dive in. People here in the Twin Cities, in Minneapolis, in Minnesota in general, like to say that we're, you know, a special place weather-wise. And then I have a friend from Manitoba, right? And he looks down here and he thinks, oh, it's not special. Like, why... I mean, in Manitoba, they shrug it off and they say, okay, well, this is just what the weather is like. And here in Minnesota, we have an exceptionalist attitude about the weather, I think. From an objective perspective, Kenny, from a scientific point of view, is our weather special?
Well, isn't the most important weather, whatever you're experiencing at any moment, isn't that sort of a Tolstoy? I think, you know... Objectively, you can't say Minneapolis is... There is no objective measure of sort of weather specialness. And one reason is because, you know, we can talk about statistical extremes of weather, but the things that we experience, these are all beheld, right? So, for example, a massive heat wave in Houston... is very different from a massive heat wave in Minneapolis. So things that we might think of as extreme, on one hand would be nothing to Houston, and on another hand would be nothing to Manitoba. So I think that, you know, we do like to congratulate ourselves a bit on enduring a wide variety of weather, and we should at the same time, I suppose, be ridiculing ourselves because why are we here if it's so bad? But I think, you know, if we were to break down the statistics, and not look at the human experience and all the sort of, you know, exceptionalism that we experience, or the sort of relativism that's required to really understand the experience, I would say, breaking down the statistics, you would have to admit that Minneapolis, St. Paul, is probably one of the largest population centers to have such extreme weather in the world. I mean, there really aren't cities this big that have this much weather.
Like, what's the population of Ulaanbaatar in Mongolia? Do you have any idea?
No.
Me neither. But that would be a similar extreme place, right?
Well, they're going to be extreme in, you know, one or two dimensions, which is they are severely inland and continental, yeah. And therefore they can get very cold, and they can, I'm sure, get very hot, but they're not going to get humid. They're not going to get, you know, gigantic. Well, they're not going to get supercell thunderstorms, and they're not going to have quite the variety that we have. You know, the other areas that do have the kind of variety we have would be like Winnipeg, which is a large, you know, large city. It gets, you know, maybe fewer thunderstorms, but they still can get tornadoes and severe weather, and their blizzards make ours look pretty puny. But they don't have, you know, they're not quite as large a region. And no. So, yeah, most of the contenders would be in our continent. But you could go to parts of, you could definitely go to parts of Eastern Europe and, you know, Western Russia on the north end, the north side, and
like
you'd
Minsk.
Find, yeah, Minsk and, you know, into the Baltics. And they're going to have, there you're going to have thunderstorms and blizzards. But you're probably not going to have tornadoes. You're probably not going to have quite the extreme in terms of all the sort of different chapters of weather that we have. But
can I tell you what I know about this? Because I,
sure.
as a geographer myself, and someone who's listened to you talk and read many emails that you've written to me about the weather. I feel like I have a rudimentary knowledge, and I want to just make sure that I'm not completely stupid. Okay, so Twin Cities is interesting because it's continental. It's so far from the oceans that you lose any sort of moderating impact of having large bodies of water that heat and cool more slowly than the land does, right?
That was impressive, yes.
And so that makes it sort of, that's why it has these extreme shifts from the heat in the summertime to the extreme cold in the wintertime, because we're so far inland.
I will throw in one exception to that, which is, so if you go about 1,500 miles to the south, of course, you run into the Gulf of Mexico. And there's very little in the way of major topography between us and the Gulf of Mexico. So when the wind comes out of the south or south-southeast, we basically are sort of importing that influence of water, and that's where it becomes more humid. And you might notice too, when it's more humid, the difference between the daytime and nighttime temperatures goes way, way down, because it just stays warm. It's like 80 at night and 95.
I noticed this last night, in fact. But
right.
Is that light still on?
It is still
okay,
on.
Good. Last night was I was biking from northeast Minneapolis back home and back. So, you know, it's like 12 miles. And it was like a foggy evening, right? And it was only 40 degrees, but it felt really cold because the moisture in the air. What was going on with that?
Yeah, so it was foggy. It felt cold. Yeah, it was probably because the moisture was actually, you know, there was actual condensation going on.
Yeah.
So you were basically taking a tiny little bath in the air. It was like tiny little droplets.
Yeah,
and
it's a cold bath.
And it's a cold bath.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I made it.
Yeah.
And, okay, so we have these extremes based on our continentality. And then we also have this this kind of humidity shifts throughout the year, right? So we have really humid summers and really dry winters because of that shifting sort of moisture effect from the Gulf of Mexico.
Generally.
Is that stupid?
Sure.
No.
For the most part, one of the reasons winter is generally dry because, our prevailing winds shift to the northwest. And if you just look off to our northwest, all those places are really dry.
Yeah.
Summertime, we get warm and humid because, A, our prevailing winds are out of more of a southerly direction. And if you look to our south, Yeah, those places are warm and humid. And you go far enough south and it's the Gulf of Mexico. And then the second reason is, of course, we have tons of crops and trees. And all of those then conduct more moisture into the atmosphere from the soil. And in fact, corn is one of the reasons it's become so ridiculously humid over parts of the upper Midwest. But we can talk about that a different time.
Okay, okay. And then here's another. So you were talking about thunderstorms a little bit. And,
yes.
And that's something that makes us a little bit unique as well. It's partly the moisture and partly the way in which the jet stream or something
sure.
like shifts over this part of the country a lot, right? Creating these fronts that come through here.
Yeah, I mean, basically, because we have access to that deep moisture from the Gulf of Mexico, we are probably, for a place that's as continental and as extreme as we are, you know, this part of the United States, and that includes, you know, from Kansas up through Nebraska, Iowa, the Dakotas, Minnesota, and into parts of southern Canada, I'd say that corridor is unique for being so continental, also having access to deep moisture occasionally, which, you know, when these air masses are in proximity to one another, this is where you get those really severe thunderstorms. And so the one thing that we have that other extreme climate regions in the world don't have is we have these, you know, gigantic supercell thunderstorms, which are the big rotating ones that produce large hail and sometimes tornadoes. We're not the only place in the world that has them, but we are sort of what we call Tornado Alley here is, I think, unmatched. There's definitely little pockets around the world that have big tornadoes in Bangladesh and Australia. But again, if you look at the other regions that have tornadoes, they don't do winter like we do. You know, they don't, and they don't have almost everything else. So again, that's one of the things that makes us unique. And I'm sure if I lived in these other places, though, I'd find 18,000 things that make them unique, too. And be like, well, you know what Minnesota doesn't have? I can't say what it is because I.
Everywhere is special.
Oh, yeah, everywhere is special. It's wherever you are.
One of my pet peeves that I've wanted to talk to you about for a while, Kenny, is one of the things that does make us special is our desire to hide from the weather and to pretend that it doesn't exist, right? So we invented the indoor shopping mall here, right? We domed all our stadiums if we could, you know, and I feel like the Skyway system is another example of this.
Right.
Where we attempted, if at all possible, to like be able to walk around in January in our pajamas and flip-flops. Like, that's like the goal of a lot of people's lives, it seems like to me. And our urban design values are aligned with this, right? With the idea of
yeah.
of pretending that winter doesn't exist or that summer doesn't exist and that we can all live in L.A. even though we're near Minneapolis. What do you think about that? Is that true?
Well, so I am a proponent of people experiencing weather as much as possible. And so I think we're probably aligned here, but for different reasons, perhaps. I mean, yeah, I've used Skyways, and sure, I've been to a number of Twins games in the Metrodome. And
you've been to a mall before.
And I've been to a mall before. And I've even done that thing where I'm going somewhere else, but the mall is nearby, and I walk through the mall to get to that somewhere else. Lame. I'm not sure that the design is so much about pretending that the season doesn't exist as it is admitting sort of utter defeat and utter incompetence in our ability to actually cope with it, which I think is complete bogus. I mean, we are equipped to handle the elements in at least small doses. I mean, you can be outside.
Yeah.
Even when it's brutally cold, you can actually be outside. You can be outside for extended periods of time if you think it through. But I think we're getting to a state now where we don't even have to think, because you can live inside, take an elevator down to your heated parking lot, get in your car when it's nice and warm, drive out, and then go to work in a heated parking lot. And you can avoid being outside the entire time.
Isn't that a terrible thing that we've created here? This kind of system of technology that allows us to ignore the world around us?
Well, I would say as the urban critic, you're probably better equipped to discuss that. But I could say that, you know, what if the grid fails, or if there's some disaster, or if, you know, the shipments of oil don't make it in, someone, you know, there is a zero missing on the invoice. Right. I mean, like, you know, what are we going to do? How are we going to cope? And I think that we have definitely set ourselves up for failure in that way. I don't think that we're any longer a culture or a society that really understands how to survive. I mean, I've talked about this with people a lot, about how, you know, we complain about the weather. It's definitely a part of our culture. And I grant everybody, we all have the right to do it. And anybody, anywhere, can complain about whatever they want. It's part of the human condition.
I like complaining about people that complain too much.
Yeah, right. But I think one of the things in terms of the weather that I've noticed is that, you know, we are doing this more and more frequently from a state where we're not even really able to appreciate the weather that we're complaining about. I mean, it's like, oh, it's so hot in these 4 minutes that I'm spending outside on this day where I'm otherwise spending the majority of my time in the air-conditioned, you know, artificially cooled environment. Or, oh my goodness, it's so cold outside, except, you know, I've spent 23 hours and 52 minutes inside and really haven't experienced the cold but for 8 minutes, and therefore can't even notice things that I think meteorologically and climatologically are really important, like this kind of cold, which you're now only experiencing for 10 or 15 minutes at a time, as opposed to, you know, what you might have experienced 25 or 50 or 100 years ago as multiple hours. You're not even noticing then that it's not the same degree of cold.
Yeah.
You know, and you're at the same time, you're not noticing that the summer heat is way worse. Than it used
people
to
didn't
be.
Even need air conditioners 30 years. Well, I don't know when did air conditioners.
I think they hit hardcore in the 50s and 60s when they really started getting.
I mean, that's one of the things that really changed our urban landscape too. I think about a pre-air conditioner South, the Southern United States, right, the Sun Belt, and what how you had to design homes back then. And I was in Tampa, Florida, and it was there's a beautiful old a University of Southern Florida, it's called. It's in Tampa, and it's got this one really old building from the 20s, and it's got all these awnings, like big porches that keep all the sunlight from entering into the main room, and the tall ceilings and ceiling fans, and like this wind the thing is designed to create these cross breezes.
Oh, sure.
And you know, it's a way to keep cool in the warm weather without having air conditioning being doing all the work for you. And we used to design buildings and cities and whatever with that in mind. And now we can just plop down the same rectangular box and, you know, no matter where we are. And I wonder what those technologies were for Minnesota that were like that. Like, how did you have to design a home back in the day to keep... I mean, it seems like they were all very energy inefficient in the winter. Like, the old house I was in didn't even have insulation.
It's because we had an abundance of trees, right?
Oh, yeah. We could just chop them all down.
Or we had the big octopus furnaces, you know, and you just load a bunch of coal. And coal was, I mean, also unlimited at the time. Yeah. I think that... you know, another thing this makes me consider, too, is, you know, our vehicles, they keep us climate controlled. And so imagine, you know, driving 45 minutes in blazing heat to get to work if you didn't have air conditioning in your car. So you can think of the way that climate control, not just in the indoor environment, but in the mobile environment, has actually helped sort of sustain this, you know, sprawling suburbanization that we've experienced. I mean, if you couldn't drive in comfort, you weren't going to move far from your work. No way. Uh-huh. You know, not in this kind of region.
And I think everybody who's had a car where the air conditioner breaks in the summertime knows what you're talking about right now.
Yeah, I had that happen. I actually had, so I had this car, I guess it was the summer of 2000 and 2011, I had this car. We called it the Jumbo Jet, and it was a this horrendous vehicle. I mean, this was from a dark period in my life. Apparently, it was a Toyota Camry from 1988. So at one time, this was a very nice car, and since that time, you know, a number of things had happened to the car, and apparently, you know, what I like to say is somebody had, who was a very heavy smoker. Apparently someone who is a very heavy smoker had crawled into the radiator and died. It's the stinkiest car ever. And there were, you know, like claw marks all over the seat because apparently there had been some sort of a cougar attack. But, yeah, when I bought the car, it was winter time. And so, if you were test driving a car in Minnesota in late November or December, you are not going to turn on the air conditioner. I mean, this was a used car, right? So I was like not even thinking. What I was looking for was, does this thing drive? And the answer is kind of. And, you know, do the doors close? Well, kind of. Does the cloud of smoke behind the car eventually go away? Yeah, kind of. So it was, it was a passable car, but I did not check the air conditioner. And so then that summer, 2011 was brutally hot. And, you know, I mean, most summers at some point are brutally hot, but 2011 had a couple periods that were ridiculous, and we were experiencing those the old-fashioned way, which really meant that we just drove as little as we could. I mean, it's like, get from wherever we were to a beach maybe, but we weren't going to do long road trips in that kind of heat. And then the next year I got a car that was about, it was another Camry, and it was like 10 years or 9 years newer. And but I also bought it in the winter. So
did you learn your lesson at the very least, Kenny?
No, because I wasn't even thinking. I was just the same thing. This is a better car. This works. Yeah, right. This is a better car. This thing is clean. It doesn't stink too much. There's no, you know, the doors until recently all worked. And there's no cloud of smoke behind it. So there's a major upgrade. But yeah, as soon as summer heat hit, I realized there was no air conditioner in there. And we ended up getting it fixed, but it didn't, you know, we had the Freon recharged, but there was a leak. And so within a day it was gone and we had to go on this road trip. And I had the kids and we were driving like 5 hours and it was 97 degrees. And, you know, our only hope for relief was to pull over occasionally and find a gas station. And so I can't even say we were experiencing summer the old-fashioned way because we had these outs because we knew there was air conditioning. We were, you know, three gas stations away from really experiencing it the old-fashioned way. And the whole thing kind of made me think of how, yeah, when we do complain about the heat, we're doing it from this really privileged standpoint where we don't even experience the weather that we're complaining about. You know, we really don't.
Well, I mean, okay, you're right. In fact, I think it's not usually as bad as you think it's going to be. Like, I find this to be true a lot, where you look out the window and you imagine something that's horrible. Like, a gray day, you know, it's like, it's winter outside and you look out and you imagine it to be horrible, and then you end up actually doing something outside and it's not so bad. As a bicyclist, that's what I experience a lot. Like, it's rarely as bad as I imagine it's going to be. There are occasional exceptions to that rule. But I think the same thing would be true if you tried to walk somewhere. I don't know.
I think that the advantage that you have is that you're spending that neurotic time contemplating how bad it is. And that's really critical because in doing so, you're probably making sure if it's hot, you have enough water.
Yeah.
Or if it's cold, that you're bundled enough.
Yeah.
And I think where people get into trouble with the weather is by not being at all neurotic and thinking, I can handle it. And actually, you know, yeah, the weather is survivable if you're smart and it's extreme. But if you're not smart or you're not thinking about it, it can be very difficult to survive, you know, sub-zero temperatures if you have one layer.
I see that all the time on the bus, you know, people riding the bus and they're wearing like sweatshirts.
Yeah, there's always the guy with the jeans jacket, right? Like there's always the guy with the jeans jacket and it's like negative 30. And it's like he's clearly got a jeans jacket and one layer below that.
Yeah. Anyway, I wanted you to tell me a little bit. You were talking about tornadoes a second ago. Actually, that was a long time ago now.
Yeah.
But what are the great legendary Minnesota disasters, like where entire towns got destroyed, or like how many tornadoes have struck Minneapolis proper, or things like
goodness.
These kinds of questions?
Can sure. Well, so in terms of Minnesota weather disasters, there's really almost too many to name, and...
What are your favorites?
Well, I don't have favorites because these
tragedies.
Are all tragedies.
What's your
okay, I think one that people should know about was that in the 19th century, late 19th century, I think it was 1895, in what I think would reasonably be considered part of the Twin Cities metropolitan area now, just on the other side of the St. Croix River in Wisconsin, in New Richmond, there was a huge tornado that went basically across the St. Croix River from just north of Stillwater into New Richmond.
That's basically where that bridge is
going to
be built.
Yeah, fairly close to the bridge project. And this was, there was a traveling circus that was in town, and this tornado wiped out the entire, like, everything that was at the time New Richmond, Wisconsin. And the deaths were... I think the official tally is 117, but if you actually read the book that was written about that event, the author very clearly says, look, it was too hot. So they were just toe-tagging people that couldn't be identified. They were just covering people who couldn't be identified and sort of toe-tagging them and not counting them. There were probably far more than 117, which would make, I mean, it was one of the, you know, it's like one of the top 10 sort of single event killer tornadoes in U.S. history.
Huh. Was it like an elephant swirling around in the tornado, like a traveling circus? Like I don't want to, this is 100 years ago, so we can have a little bit of a sense of humor about it, right?
Yeah, the juggler was up. Yeah, there's like, you know, and the tightrope walker was still walking, you know.
Like, my imagination is running wild with this.
So that was one of, you know, pretty significant weather disasters that, you know, was within 50 miles of the heart of the Twin Cities. There have been a lot of tornadoes, you know, about five for sure that have actually been recorded in Minneapolis. Six.
Well, like the North Minneapolis one that happened two years ago or whatever.
Well, there's the one in North Minneapolis. Yeah.
And then there was the one that that knocked over the steeple of the church, the Lutheran
church.
That was
in 2009.
And Michelle Bachman said that was an act of God for... like gay marriage or something?
I think if Michelle Bachman didn't say that, she should have. Yeah, and then there were tornadoes in Minneapolis in 1984, in 1981, 1965. Did I say there were only five? There's been like nine. Sorry. 1952 and 51. There have been numerous.
Have you ever noticed how so there's one of them was right along central Minneapolis on Fifth Avenue.
Okay.
Right, there's a certain part of Minneapolis between on Fifth Avenue between like 33rd Street and 46th Street, right by 35W,
right.
Where the trees are all really low, like
right.
They're all small, and it's because a tornado had come through there and knocked all the trees over.
Right.
And that part of the city feels really weird to walk around in, like because there aren't these canopy trees that you would expect to see, and it almost feels naked, like this part of the city is naked.
Yeah, it's like the tornado came and destroyed our sense of place in a way, because Minneapolis is a city with trees and its neighborhoods,
yeah.
Right?
And that part feels strange when you ride or that, walk through
that,
it.
That tornado, that was the one in August of 2009. You know, we don't... It's interesting what stats are not kept by, you know, the people who study severe weather. But I've been trying to figure out... So this was the lowest ranked tornado that you can have. It was an EF0 because all it did was, you know, it knocked over trees, some onto roofs. But the structural damage was pretty minimal, and I think it was the most expensive or costly EF0 tornado in U.S. history, because when you put even a weak tornado in an urban area, you're going to have a large, you know, property damage toll. And so, yeah, there's that 1 mile long corridor right next to 35W where, yeah, there's no trees anymore. And if you went back and looked at the area in 2009, there was roof damage and, you know, a little bit of structural damage to the houses themselves and the garages. So, yeah, there's been, but that's pretty minor compared to the tornadoes that went through in, say, 1981, where there was a long track tornado that touched down near the Edina Theater in Edina.
50th and France?
Yeah, right around 50th and France. And then it tracked over the Linden Hills neighborhood. And anyone who knows, like, Baird's Plaisance, there's this big pavilion, and it actually picked up the pavilion and tossed it into the lake, crossed over the lake, and then it gets kind of legendary because it pulled a ton of fish out of the lake. And then, you know, this is pretty common.
Like Sharknado, we're talking here.
Tornadoes can entrain smaller things into their circulation and keep them there for a while.
Sharknado, Kenny?
I did. You know, how did I not see Sharknado?
You should watch it.
I know, I really should. It sounds unbelievable in the truest sense of the word. Anyway, that storm ended up at the Harmar target, and it was in Roseville,
wow,
and it was pretty much, it was a good distance, and it actually tracked right between downtown Minneapolis and the University of Minnesota. And I think it, you know, kind of just went through a sort of industrial corridor there and didn't really affect any people, and it happened to be a Sunday, but imagine that on a Monday or a Friday. But when it,
especially because you students, I would imagine, don't have really good instincts for running away from giant storms.
Yeah, I don't even know what they would have done in 1981.
Yeah,
without smartphones and things to take pictures with, I don't know. They just would have gawked, I guess. The but when it hit the target, allegedly, right? It as it was overturning cars in the parking lot and whatnot, it was also losing some of its intensity, and it was beginning to, apparently its updraft could not support the fish that had been entrained into the circulation, so a lot of them ended up in the Target parking lot.
Is that a true story?
It's a quasi true story, yes.
Is that red light still on?
Red light is still on.
Great, that's great. I like to see that.
As far as Minnesota,
I mean, is that how where the whole Plague of Frogs things comes from?
It's hard to know. I mean,
I don't know.
Yeah,
not to get religious here.
Or
but
raining cats and dogs. Maybe there was a tornado that actually pulled some cats and dogs into its circulation.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Kenny, but no tornado has ever struck St. Paul, and it's one of the weird, idiosyncratic things that, like, there's been 8 tornadoes to strike Minneapolis and 0 in St. Paul in the whole history of the city, and it must be something about another act of God, I would say, or something similar to that.
I would correct you. There was one tornado that may have gone through parts of St. Paul that ended up in the Little Canada area, Lake Jarvis or Gervais. It's on the north end, but it may have begun in St. Paul proper. But the only picture of it is from looking from, basically from the high, what is now the High Bridge. And there's a fairly photogenic and popular picture of that tornado. That one might have hit St. Paul. And then there was this thing that in 1904 that knocked down the original High Bridge.
Really?
Now, it was reported as a tornado, and it holds Minnesota's record, or until recently, the record for the strongest wind recorded on top of the old Pioneer Press building, was a wind gust of 189 miles an hour. But that is actually, we don't believe that was actually a tornado, but it was reported as one. It was reported as a cyclone. But incidentally, Minneapolis also reported a cyclone that day. And it's probably more symptomatic of a very high-end straight-line wind outbreak.
So that's kind of like a bridge disaster in the equivalence of that one out in the Tacoma Narrows Bridge, right?
Yeah,
sort of thing, where the wind blows the bridge down?
The Tacoma Narrows, that was an amazing windstorm. This was a probably direct bombardment from the debris that was being lofted by these very strong winds. These were, you know, for the winds to be over 100 miles an hour for any duration would be enough, given the way construction of bridges used to be, to take it down.
I mean, but now our bridges would never fall down.
No. They're totally foolproof. You're correct. You're right, though. There's not a lot of documented evidence of actual tornadoes in St. Paul.
Can you, actually, I made that statistic up, Kenny, and I'm amazed that it's that sort of true.
It's kind of true. It's plausible.
That's something to think about, ladies and gentlemen, if you're deciding which of the Twin Cities to live in. It's just something to think about. I'm not saying it's the only criteria, but... I wanted you to explain to me what the urban heat island effect is and whether or not there are any... whether or not there's anything we can do about it. Like what are the variables in creating that?
Well, I mean, okay, so the urban heat island is basically, if you take whatever the natural landscape is and you just add a bunch of pavement and brick and building-type materials to it and streets and whatnot, it's going to absorb more sunlight. And then...
What's albedo? Define that for me, Lane.
Okay.
It's not libido.
No. They're
sort of
similar.
Like libido for the sunlight.
Yeah, they're similar. Yeah, libido and albedo are yeah, they're almost the same definition.
Brothers.
Yeah, albedo is the proportion of sunlight or light, direct light, that gets reflected off of an object. And so... things that are really shiny have high albedo. So snowpack, for example, white and silvery things have very high albedo. Mirror-like objects have very high albedo. And the wise men is extremely high albedo.
Frank Gehry's building.
Yes. Now what this means, and anybody who's seen the wise men, it's this like, you know, geometric, abomination.
It's like a crystalline shard thing, science fiction looking.
It's cool and it's, you know, artsy and it's kind of marginally functional, but it's mostly silver and shiny and geometrically irregular. And so it's a bunch of mirrors. And what it does is when the sun shines on it at different angles, rather than just being like a regular cube or a regular sort of tall cube, it's a... It has all these opposing angles and odd angles, so the light bounces off of it in weird ways, and it can actually bounce off the snow and then hit the building and then bounce back to the snow. And so around the Wiseman in the wintertime, especially at the end of winter, you'll see these very strange snowmelt patterns from all the ways that the light is bouncing off of that building and off of the snow around it. Well, in any case, albedo is, light buildings... Things that are really light in color or really shiny, they reflect heat away. And if heat is being reflected away, it means it's not being absorbed. You know, if light is being reflected away, then the heat is not being absorbed. So, for example, a snowpack is really shiny, and therefore all the heat that could be heating you up is instead escaping.
That's why you get sunburned when you're skiing sometimes.
You can actually, because you're getting basically 90% of the sun's intensity being bounced off of the snow, essentially. And so, you get nice sunburn from the snow, just like you do from water. In any case, buildings are made from materials, especially older buildings, that are really low albedo and very absorptive of sunlight. And so then they radiate much more heat than the natural environment would. And then when you add on, asphalt and old brick and cobblestone streets and whatnot, urban areas were traditionally much hotter than the surrounding rural landscapes, because the surrounding rural landscapes had all kinds of shade and had, green vegetation.
So green albedo is like 40% or something like that.
Yeah, it depends on what kind of green and what kind of plants we're talking about. But yeah, so albedo goes from 0 to 100% or from 0 to, 1.0. And the things that are really close to 1 are like snow and mirrors and, shiny water at when the sun's at low angles, and things that are really close to zero are like dark bare soils and asphalt and, you know, things that are really dark in color. And then the natural landscape is kind of on the low end of halfway between the two in general. And the urban, traditional older urban landscapes are more like, you know, 70%, 65, 70. And there's just a lot more absorption of that sunlight and therefore a lot more heat that's radiated. So all that infrastructure essentially absorbs more light and therefore radiates more heat and keeps the area a lot warmer.
So that affects storm patterns, right? When if there's rain, is this true or not?
Well, yeah. I mean, it can affect storm patterns when the environmental winds are weak. So on those days where there's not a lot happening in the atmosphere, there's no big jet stream screaming overhead, but instead the winds throughout the environment are fairly weak, then storms that develop will preferentially form over and downwind of the urban heat island. So, but it becomes less true when the when we get into what we call synoptic weather patterns, where there's strong winds or you've got a big cold front coming through, things like that.
Yeah. Well, that kind of matches, I think, a lot of people's experience. Does that start to explain why a lot of weathermen on TV predict snow that never happens? You know?
No.
Not to point fingers?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think we have a different problem with snow that doesn't necessarily have to do with some sort of interference from the urban area. Snow is very hard to predict. And we've gotten a lot better at it. And the computer models that we rely on are certainly better at helping us understand when the processes that support snow are going to be really ramped up and good to go. But sometimes we have it off, not just for the city, but for the whole region. It looks like snow, but it ends up being rain, or it looks like snow, but nothing falls at all. That's just one of the difficulties with understanding some of the subtle mechanisms. We've gotten a lot better. The meteorologists who do this for a living have gotten a lot better, but it's still not so easy.
Are you aware of any like technological changes that are like changing the heat island? Is there something? The reason it's bad, from what I understand, is that it increases cooling costs for the city, right? Like if it's 5 degrees warmer and during the summertime, or what is the usual difference between, let's say, a rural area and an urban area?
Oh, it depends on the prevailing weather pattern, but if you take one of those really sort of nasty late July heat waves, typically the cities will remain, you know, maybe five, maybe they'll be 4 or 5 degrees warmer during the day than the surrounding, even the sort of outer ring suburbs. But the main thing is at night, when all the outer ring suburbs start cooling off, the urban areas will remain up to 10, maybe even 12 degrees warmer.
Wow, that's a really stark difference.
Yeah, it's a huge difference. And another area that it's critical for is just, you know, personal cooling. You get into more health-related issues and heat, you know, heat exhaustion and heat stroke, because your body's natural ability to cool itself down is compromised if you don't have air conditioning. We're back to that.
Yeah.
And so you get, that urban heat island can exacerbate a already pretty nasty heat wave by keeping it that much warmer, especially at night in the urban areas. And that's really where you see the urban heat island really kind of shows its stuff at night and
so
in the winter too.
What are white roofs a thing? I mean, I saw an article, and in the Southwest they use these sometimes. Are planting trees a thing that helps?
Yeah. Anything that would increase the amount of shade, put you under the canopy, would improve the temperature beneath that canopy. You know, so if the urban heat island is, you know, absorbing a lot of sunlight, and therefore radiating additional heat, then one way you could offset that is by putting a big canopy up that prevent some of that sunlight from making it to the dark surfaces that would absorb it and radiate more heat, and therefore that would keep the temperature cooler. So trees can do that nicely. Yeah, white roofs. You know, our area hasn't done a tremendous amount to deal with the urban heat island. Atlanta has done substantially more with a lot of green roofs and a lot of trees and some recoloring of rooftops and whatnot. So I think that people have to be motivated to see that as a major issue before they'll do anything.
Yeah, we had other fish to fry, I guess. I don't know.
I mean, I don't know if we have other fish to fry. I just think that because we spend 7 months complaining about how cold it is, I think when the months come that people want to complain about how hot it is, it never rises to the surface as a hot-button issue.
So I think 2 years ago I wrote a blog post about we had this November, and then this it was the Super Bowl race. You know about this race, the bike race in January, February,
This is the bar-to-bar bike thing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, anyway, really it was like smart. 50 degrees that day, and then we had some 60-degree days in November where it was pretty balmy. Like, people would sit outside in the street cafes and whatever, and I was just kind of struck by maybe how the climate here is going to become a lot easier, a lot harder for people to complain about so much, right?
Do
you think that's true?
Yeah, and I think that won't prevent people from complaining about it. You know, we've been talking, we've been on this other project that I have. We're working on this movie about winter in Minnesota.
I wanted to talk about that.
And,
what's it called again?
It's called The Story of Winter.
Okay.
And we've been talking to people, and we're trying to, you know, it's a combination of sort of person on the street interviews with.
I think you should change the name to The End of Winter.
And there's a piece on that, though. There's a piece about, you know, what's happening to winter, and the winter's sort of dying. But, you know, it's interesting how resistant people are to the notion that our winter actually is changing, is totally changing. It is undergoing profound transformation.
It's because everyone's a snowblower salesman.
Well, it's not just that. It's that, you know, we're not. I think the more inside we are, the less keen our sense of being able to observe and compare becomes. And so the same thing we were talking about before, spending 8, 10, 20 minutes outside a day, and you lose your ability to think of what it's really like and what it used to be like. Maybe this is a piece of it, but we hear a lot of people saying that winter's not going anywhere, the changes have been small and subtle. And I think, you know, it's always going to get dark during winter. That's not changing. Winter will always be our cold season. But what it used to be is gone. I mean, it's gone. Like, we are not in our lifetimes. Well, I shouldn't say we're not going to get it back ever, because you're always going to have one or two winters that can do it. And who knows, there could be some tremendous volcanic eruption that sort of darkens everything for a while.
Okay, barring a tremendous volcanic eruption that darkens everything for a while.
You know, everything just sort of proceeds as it has been. Yeah, we're losing winter, or we're at least losing the character of winter as we used to experience it. And I think that there are going to be a lot of people who are going to hold out, and they're holding out on their right to complain about it.
Well, I'm holding on to my cross-country skis, Kenny, even though I don't have a lot of hope for them.
Well, yeah, I mean, you'll be able to use them occasionally, but you won't be able to use them with the frequency that you
The couple winters on the last decade were just tremendous, where a couple months of good skiing in a row. But I don't think that's going to be a normal thing.
No.
In the Twin Cities?
So the winter you were just talking about.
Yeah, 2 years ago.
2011 and 2012. This was the winter where people who normally are sick of me talking about the weather or don't care about what I'm saying, they were actually coming up to me and be like, "Hey, Kenny, wow, this is creepy. What's going on? This is disturbing. What's happening?" I think that was for where we have been and what's sort of normal now, that was an outlier. For where we're going, no, it was just a preview. And we're going to have more of those. I mean, if you look back over the last 20 years, we've just been building towards that kind of thing. So what are we building towards next? I mean, you know, 2 winters ago, that seemed unprecedented and totally bizarre. But in 20 winters, it'll probably seem relatively normal, and something else will seem unprecedented and bizarre.
Do you care to make any predictions about this coming winter that's about to happen in about a week?
Well, okay, so, you know, I do a weather forecast for a weekly weather forecast for a radio station in Wisconsin, and they really want me to present myself as an expert all the time, and I'm like, okay, I can do some forecasting, but I have to admit that I don't know anybody who does long-term forecasts.
Well, that's why it's ludicrous. It, obviously, yeah. Our audience does not expect you to be knowledgeable.
So I just want to say that I, like the ones who get paid to do this, am a lousy long-term forecaster.
Well, everyone's a lousy long-term
forecaster. I think it's all... Okay, here's where you're safe. Bet on warmer than the historical normal, which means take the averages from 1981 to 2010... And from December, January, and February, I think we'll be warmer than those averages. Which is actually, that period now includes, a substantial portion of that period was
really warm,
pretty influenced by global warming. And I'm still saying we're going to be warmer than that normal period. And in terms of snow, boy, I think that we're going to have large periods where there's no... I shouldn't say no snow on the ground, but, you know, where you don't have what we think of as significant snow cover, where we've got open, you know, snow-free periods where maybe there's snow under the eaves, maybe there's snow under the bushes, but bare lawns maybe in January. I think that we'll have a couple good snowstorms, but I also think we'll have some couple runs of substantial warmth. And, you know, for people who like being outside, that's probably good news. But for people who love winter and are looking for reasons to believe that winter is not leaving, it's probably not good news.
Oh, man.
But then again,
It's depressing, right?
Well, okay, so it's personal,
yeah,
right? I can't tell people how to feel. It makes me sad because I think of winter as this thing. I love it. I mean, it's like a character in my life. And so I have friends who ask me, like, should I be freaked out right now? No, you shouldn't, because that's not going to do any damn good. It's going to, but what you should do is be prepared for the changes that are coming. And we can try and sort of do good and do right, but we're not undoing this one. We are not undoing this one.
I have very little optimism for our whole society to change.
Well, I mean, there's no evidence that we've never actually brought something back to its natural state, whatever natural state was. We've never done that. We're not going to. And I think that, you know, if you appreciate winter, if you really love winter, including those brutally cold days where you can't actually go outside for more than a few minutes without jeopardizing yourself, but if you still love all of that, then I think that you should be preparing to say goodbye. And that's what I think Minnesotans and people in the upper Midwest have to come to grips with, that this winter will always be here. Because it's always going to get dark and there will always be a cold time of the season. But this thing that we have celebrated, that used to be such an important part of our culture, oh yeah, it might stick around for another decade or two or three on and off, but it's already in, you know, such extreme transformation.
Kind of like the moose population.
Except it's different because the moose are still moose,
yeah,
right? Whereas what we are calling winter is different from what we used to call winter. And what we will be calling winter is different from what we are calling it now. And we are on this, you know, and it's just going to be a much milder, it's going to be an unrecognizable version of what it used to be. And I think, you know, if it were a patient, if we viewed it as a patient, we would have to admit, and we'd have to start going through the Kubler-Ross grieving process of like, okay, look, we're in denial. This thing is dying.
Is that what your movie's about?
No, the movie actually is really about how we experience winter, and it's simultaneously technical and fun, and we're getting at how people experience winter and what winter is meteorologically. There's sort of a bit at the end about what's happening to winter. And there is definitely a piece where, you know, I mean, it's emotional for me. And if I'm going to be talking about winter, there's this gigantic elephant in the room. If we don't talk about the obvious fact that, like, this thing that used to be really dependable and these experiences that used to be so generalizable.
Our lives, but all of life in you know, in this part of the planet Earth.
Right.
Everything was defined by having to survive winter.
Yeah.
A certain kind of winter. And trees evolved to do that, and animals and insects and everything. And people shaped their patterns of movement based on this, as did the birds and butterflies and everything.
Yes. Indeed. And so I think from that standpoint, yeah, there is some mourning for sure. Indeed.
Wow.
But it's otherwise, you know, the movie itself is just about winter, which is this kind of humorous character in our lives. You know, think of it as an annoying uncle or this person that comes to the party every time, you know, like right now, we know you were talking about
winter's
it. You were,
gonna show.
You know, you were talking about it in terms that are very similar to how we're framing it. It's like, it is out there looming, and it's like, and we know it's coming. And, you know, and winter is like this big personality. It has an entourage. It's like, oh, I haven't arrived yet, but my friends have. You know, meet birds flocking south. Meet, you know, here come falling leaves. Meet, you know, all these other sort of messengers that foretell.
Which,
I don't know. I mean, I haven't decided, but that's something we're interested in. If you think of winter as a character, you know, does it have a gender? Does it have a personality type? Like, who is it? I don't know. I can't define that for other people, but I definitely know, you know, for me, it's actually this much more intimate, you know, it's a nice character.
Yeah.
But it does loom, and it's back there, and we all know it's coming.
Yeah.
So.
Well, Kenny, on that note, let's wrap this up. And okay. Thank you for talking to me today.
Well, thanks for having me on, Bill. It's
okay.
Good to talk with you. I hope. Did we cover any of the things that we set out to talk about?
I checked off my entire list.
All right. Excellent. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to the Streets.mn podcast. If you have any feedback or ideas, you can comment on Streets.mn on Twitter at StreetsMN, or you can email me personally at blindicky@gmail.com. So long from downtown St. Paul.